Laila Tov, Verev Tov. This is the 16th and absolutely the best one. This is the one that I've been looking forward to. I couldn't wait until number 16 that I could be here together with you. So I teach at Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University. I teach at Yeshiva College. I teach at Tzai Sim School of Business. I teach in the Azrieli Graduate School. I teach in Yeshiva Sorbeno Yitzhak Al-Khanan. And it is a great pleasure for me to be here. YU sends me to Israel for the last 4 or 5 years to come for a week to make the rounds in the various schools that we have a connection to. Every single semester I make it my business to teach a course at Stern College. I've had many of your alumni who have gone through my classroom. I understand that a number of you are planning to make your way to our institution. It would be a pleasure to see you, and certainly a pleasure to see you in my classroom. For those of you who are not planning to come to Stern College, we wish you well in your journey. Those of you who will be going to other universities, those of you who will be staying in Israel, maybe Shavuot Lumi, maybe Aliyah, whatever your life takes you, we wish you absolute shalom and shalva and nacha and joy, happiness and fulfillment. But meanwhile, you're here. And it's hard for me to say this, hard for me, I don't want to break it to you, but it's about halfway through almost. And those of you who are planning only to stay for 1 year, some of you are Shana Bet, some of you do stay Shana Bet. If you're spending only 1 year, so we're already, a couple of days ago, there was a day that were you living in the United States, it may have had an impact on you. It's some day towards the end of December. That's like a big day with shopping days left to this particular day. But you have no idea what that day was because it came and went and there were no lights on the street and there were no people in costumes. But that day passing means that January 1st is coming, and January 1st is coming means that Purim is coming, means that Pesach is coming, means that June is coming, means that you're off to camp and you're going home. So now's the time to buckle down to maximize the opportunity that you have. Eze bracha, what a blessing it is for you to have had the opportunity to come to study here for a year, not only to come to study in Yerushalayim. My pleasure. Not only to come to study in Yerushalayim, but to come to this amazing and incredible institution. It's one of my favorite. Thank you so much. One of my favorite institutions, such a great Shem Tov, such great Rosh Beit Midrash. You are in the presence of greatness with this great teacher and rabbi. You know it already, but I want you to know that the rest of the world knows it. What a blessing it is that you were accepted to come to this institution. You know that many more young women applied than were accepted. You had the wisdom to apply. You had the Baruch Hashem great Hatzlacha that you were accepted, and now you have a chance to study with Rabbi Turetsky and so many other extraordinary teachers in this institution. So it's almost January, so time to buckle down, take advantage, and the experience I'm telling you that you have this year will last you for a lifetime, as long as you continue to build on it. So wherever you may end up, we certainly wish you well. One of the major issues, I would say, that faces contemporary society, and I think it's true in Israel, I believe it's certainly true in America, I would say it's true probably in most Western, if not all Western countries, is the issue of the nature of authority. So what does it mean that there is an authority? What does it mean that I have to look up to an authority? What does an authority figure have over me? What is my set of obligations to an authority figure? So it used to be, when I was your age, authority was important. So parents were really respected. Teachers, rabbis were respected. We understood that they had wisdom that we didn't have, and that we needed to defer I would even use a word that's sort of countercultural today, and that is to submit. We recognize that we needed to submit to the wisdom of those who are older and wiser than we are. As time goes on, that notion of deferring or submitting is, to use Beit Shammai Chanukah terminology, pochet v'holech. It's getting less and less. And so I know, for example, that colleagues of mine have children and in-law children who call them by their first name. So children call parents by their first name. In-law children, sort of a stranger who just parachuted into the family, who happened to marry somebody's child, the in-law child calls the in-law parents by their first name. I know of colleagues of mine who teach in various universities, their students call them by their first name. And for me, that's a siman that the space between the authority figure and us is becoming more and more collapsed. And that I also know, and I also have an idea, and I also have wisdom, and I also think, and you may think, but I also think. So the notion of authority, I think, is something under siege today, but it's particularly acute in a, not just culture, but in a religious tradition, so much of which is based on the notion of authority. So you have a rav, you have a posek, kabed et avicha ve'et imecha, that there is a wisdom in the past that's not just interesting for me to know, and not just helpful for me to know, but is actually necessary for me to know. I need to know about the wisdom of the past. The wisdom of the past is something that I have to figure out and incorporate into my life and make work for me. It's not like I'm great and the tradition has to change. The tradition is the tradition, and then I have to figure this out. Now, every generation is different. The way our Bubbies and Zadies operated with a lot of things are different than the way we operate, but it's within a certain misgeret that we need to accept, recognize, revere, and appreciate. So I give a lot of thought to the notion of authority and the role of those who came before us in our lives. What I want to do with you this evening is to look at this bigadol issue through a very narrow lens. It doesn't make sense to me to speak about it in platitudes, to speak about it in generalities. I want to take a very specific, narrow issue, and through that issue, through that narrow lens, open up for you to think about, after I leave, how this plays itself out in terms of our role vis-a-vis those who are the recipients of the wisdom of the generations of the past. And the specific lens is, what should our attitude be, not to our parents, and not to our teachers, and not to our rabbis, but what should our attitude be way, 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 way back to the avot and the imahot? In other words, to sharpen the question that I want to address, are we obligated to say that the avot and the imahot were absolute, perfect paragons of perfection, that we can't chas v'shalom say anything that is somehow even remotely critical of them? Or can we say, with obvious full awareness, recognition, and understanding, that in a trillion years we could never remotely come to what they were? But maybe, you know, I'm not so sure, it doesn't seem to me to be 100% sure about certain aspects of the behavior of some of them. So the nature of the authority, I'm going to go way back to the beginning, of Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov and Sarah and Rivka and Rachel and Leah. Let's start with them, and then we'll see the complexity of how this plays itself out, and then we'll start extrapolating from way back then, Meh Bayamim Haheim, to Bazman Hazeh. The point of departure, page 1, anybody not have
Point of Departure is page one, is an article that was published in a Yiddish newspaper called the Yiddische Tagblatt in Warsaw, Poland on April 16th, 1935. Should you be interested in the original article, which was in Yiddish, I invite you to turn to page two. Should you, for some reason, feel less comfortable in Yiddish, page two, than in English, as an act of chesed, I brought you the English translation, which is on page one. But I just want you to at least stare at page two for a moment. This is the original article. I traced it, and I found it, and I copied it. Das Yiddische Tagblatt, Warsaw, Poland, April 1935. I want to read you the title, the Yiddish title, page two, and that's it. Offener Brief, which means an open letter, von Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, from the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva of Kletzk. Kletzk was a town in Poland. They had a yeshiva. The head of the yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva, was Hagaon Rabbi Aharon Kotler. Rabbi Aharon Kotler. Stop. Question. Did any of you ever hear of Rabbi Aharon Kotler? You're shaking your head. Tell us a little bit. Do you know anything about him? It's great that you heard about him. What do you know? Anything? Yeah? Lakewood. Lakewood. What is Lakewood? Lakewood is a small, used to be horse town, tiny town in the state of New Jersey, where Rabbi Kotler in 1942 founded a yeshiva. Today, the end of 2017, that yeshiva is the largest yeshiva in the United States, like by multiples. There are thousands of Talmidim in the Lakewood yeshiva, by far the largest yeshiva in the United States. Rabbi Kotler was born in Eastern Europe, learned in Eastern Europe, married into the Meltzer family. He married the daughter of another great Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, was the Rosh Yeshiva in Kletz. In 1941, came to the United States. 42, founded a yeshiva with 6.5 boys in Lakewood, New Jersey, was not even there during the week. During the week, he was in New York trying to raise money for all of his students who he left behind in Europe, who were unable to get out, who were stuck behind the lines of the advancing Nazi forces. It was Sakanat Nefashot. He was desperately trying to get them to come to the United States. He would travel to Lakewood for Shabbat, and then over the course of time, from 6.5 became, for all I know, 6,500. Now, in April of 1935, he's the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva. What does a Rosh Yeshiva do in a traditional Makom Torah yeshiva? He stays in the Beit Midrash, and he learns with his Talmidim. He gives shiurim, he talks to them, he gives them chizuk, he lives in the Dalet Amot of the yeshiva. He does something highly irregular and unusual, and that is writes an open letter in a Yiddish newspaper. Rashi yeshiva generally didn't do that. They did not write popular letters, articles in the general mass Yiddish press. Something happened that absolutely disturbed him to such an extent that he felt the need to write this open letter. Now let's go back and let's start with the English on page one. I was recently shown the last few issues of the newspaper Heit. There was another newspaper in Warsaw in April of 1935 that was called Heit. Heit means today. Hayom. Hayom. The Das Yiddische Tagblatt newspaper was more traditional. The Heit newspaper, even though it was in Yiddish, was much more secular. It had no religious orientation. So somebody recently shows him the last few issues of the newspaper Heinz. How shocked I was to see the terrible blasphemies and the violation of the sanctity of our holy patriarchs and matriarchs that they contain. Oh my God, I read this, I'm shocked, because they're blasphemies against our holy patriarchs, Avoseinu HaKadoshim, Avoteinu HaKadoshim, V'imoteinu. The laws of our holy Torah obligate me to react to this unheard of profanation of truth, Chilul Shem Shamayim, and violation of the dignity of the Jewish nation. I thus feel compelled to depart from my usual practice, parenthesis, my usual practice is to sit in the Beit Midrash and to learn with my Talmidim, and parenthesis, and to issue the following public statement. Here is my open letter, often a brief, for the Klatska Rosh Yeshiva, Hagon Rav Aaron Kotler. I need to let the world know that what I have seen is awful, and I need to, in yeshiva language, it's called to make a macha'a. To make a macha'a means I have to make a public pronouncement that I am in absolute opposition to what I have seen. Here's the statement. The Holy Forefathers, Avoseinu HaKadoshim, who were the most luminous, loftiest, and purest personalities, the holiest creatures, represent the foundation of eternal spiritual vitality, the wellsprings of chesed and the full range of positive attributes for the entire world, for all of mankind. Not only for Jews, but everybody holds them in the absolute, total, highest esteem. The others are in fact held in the highest esteem by every nation on earth. The worst enemies of the Jews did not dare tamper with their luminous and holy image. How deep the shame. And how profound the anguish then, how terrible it is, how sad I am, how upset I am, how distraught I am, how much of a wreck I am, that this, the next two words are really harif, very strong words, that this despicable means horrifically awful, blasphemy, should appear in a Yiddish so-called nationalistic paper. How could you write such a thing? I can't let this go by. I have to leave the Beit Midrash, I have to march into the streets of Warsaw and let everybody know that this is absolutely unacceptable. Next column, towards the top, the worst victim of this betrayal are our youth. Kids are going to read this, they're going to think this is an appropriate way how to talk about the Avos and the Imahos, they're going to become misguided, they're going to not have respect. Absolutely awful, terrible. Next column, second full paragraph, every Jew must spare his household from the destructive influence of such literature. Throw it out, burn it, get rid of it, make sure your kids don't see it. It is, to come back to his language, English translation, despicable blasphemy. Okay. Now, Rabbi Kotler takes the position that the Avot and the Imahot, Avoteinu HaKadoshim, were, and I'm going to read again from the third paragraph in the first column, were the most luminous, loftiest, purest personalities, the holiest creatures, representing the foundation of eternal spiritual vitality, the wellsprings of chesed, the full range of positive attributes held in the highest esteem. They are paragons of perfection. They are the greatest of the great. They are the highest of the high. They are the most amazing of the most amazing. They are the purest of the pure, and therefore how dare the newspaper Heint publish something that diminishes this extraordinary greatness. Ad Kan Rabbi Kotler. So we know that Rabbi Kotler felt very strongly that Avoseinu HaKadoshim were the highest of the high, the holiest of the holy, the purest of the pure. But we're not done yet, because, and I'm now asking you a question, I'd like you to please answer, what data is missing before we can fully assess Rabbi Kotler's position? What do we need to know? What do we not yet know? Yes?
Well, know what they said in the newspaper.
We want to know what did they write in the newspaper, Heinz. What is it, in fact? Thank you. What is your name?
Sarah
Meira. Sarah Meira. Wonderful. Extra lollipop for Sarah Meira. What was he reacting against? What was he reacting against? Now, let me sharpen the issue. If what he was reacting against is somebody said in the Heinz something like horrifically, that we would all consider to be horrifically awful, then we would understand Ravara Cutler's position, because we would basically share Rabbi Cutler's position. But let's say they write something that we would consider to be, it's not like so nice, but it's not mamish so awful. And then we read Rabbi Cutler, and Rabbi Cutler says it's despicable blasphemy. Then we would conclude that Rabbi Cutler's position is more extreme than a conclusion that we would come to. You will understand exactly how this plays itself out, but conceptually you understand. So therefore you can't really assess the intensity or the fullness of Rabbi Cutler's position unless you know what's bothering him. Not just bothering him, what's upsetting him. Not just what's upsetting him, but what's super duper upsetting him. So I went to look for the newspaper Heinz. I read this. This came out in English translation in the early 1980s. I read it. It's very interesting. But as I just indicated to you, I can't really assess Rabbi Cutler's position unless I see what he's polemicizing against. So I went looking, did a lot of research. I found copies in microfilm. You know what microfilm? So that's a new world about microfilm. Microfilm is, they used to take pictures of text and put it on a reel like a film. You don't know what a film is either, but that's okay. That's okay. What a bracha, you were born in this generation, you know, right? Okay, fine. I was born way, way too early to appreciate your technological capabilities. So it's a reel, and you put it under a microscope, and you roll it through, and then it makes it bigger on the screen in front of you in the Sterling Library of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. So the Sterling Library in Yale University of New Haven, Connecticut has a reel of the newspaper Heinz that was published in Yiddish in Poland in Warsaw in 1935. Okay, so I make a trip, and I order the newspaper Heinz. Where do I start looking? I'm asking you a question. Answer me. Where do I start? The newspaper Heinz was about 25 years long. Where do I start looking? How do I narrow down my search? Help me. Yes. What'd you say? You didn't say anything. What should you have said? Were you to have said something? Help me. Help her. Yes? The date. Which date?
That the one
with
the article that we have.
You start with the date of the article that was written. What date was it? April?
1935.
April what? 16, 1935. You go to the Heinz, April 16, 1935, and what do you do?
Backwards.
You go backwards. So I start April 16, 1935, and I go backwards. Page 3, and I found it. I found it at the top right of page 3. It's a little bit fuzzy because it's a copy of a copy from the microfilm. So I apologize that it's not crisp, but this went through like 3 Gilgulim until it ended up on this piece of paper. Turns out the following. Right-hand side, it's Yiddish again. Wow. Anybody here know Yiddish? Hear Yiddish? Folk Yiddish? Do your bubbies is 80s or something? Yes, I see. Everybody's turning. You understand it, but you don't speak it. Okay. So here we have Yiddish, and it turns out the following. There was a poet whose name was Itzik Manger. We know a lot about Itzik Manger. Itzik Manger was born in Eastern Europe in a traditional home. Over the course of time, he rejected his traditional upbringing and became more and more secular. Somehow he survived the Shoah, the Holocaust. He ended up in Israel. He ended up in Montreal after the war, spent a lot of time in Montreal, in New York City. He died in the 1960s. Turns out
that in February, March, and the beginning of April of 1935, the newspaper Hank had a series of poems by Itzik Manger entitled Motiven von Chumash, Chumash motifs, Chumash ideas, Chumash concepts, Chumash stories. And here it is in front of us. Now, once again, as always, God is incredibly good. So what God did was motivate somebody in the year 2002 to translate Itzik Manger's poetry into English. And it was published by Yale University Press in 2002. Left side of page 3, The World According to Itzik, Selected Poetry and Prose. So here is what I am now about to do. I am now about to be quiet. And I am not going to say a word for, let's say, 60 seconds. And I am going to invite you in the course of those 60 seconds to read the left side of page 3. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to choose a number, each of you individually, between 1 and 10. 1 means... It's not so nice, but all right. Ten being Rabbi Turetsky. How could you possibly have invited a heretic from Yeshiva University to come into this Beit Midrash in front of these holy books and bring in such drivel, disgusting nonsense that offends me to the core? That's a 10. A 10 is, oh my God, I have to get up early tomorrow. Thank God it's a fast day. I'm going to fast the whole day to do tshuva for reading such disgusting things. 1 is, I don't know if I would say that. All right, relax. Okay, I'm stopping. When I'm done, I'm going to ask you for a number from 1 to 10. Okay, Bavakasha, take your time, but you take you no more than 60 seconds to read the poem. Ten more seconds. Not everybody's face is up yet. I see a few smiles. I see a few frowns. Okay. Bavakasha, give me a number.
I would say, maybe 5.
Maybe 5. Maybe 5. Because maybe more than 5 or maybe...
7 area.
5 to 6. So now maybe 5 became 7.
Yeah.
So give me a number. A number.
7.
You started maybe 5. What happened between the maybe 5 and the 7?
The more I think about it, the more...
The more you think about it, more you're upset. But you're upset up to a 7. It's not an 8. It's not really an 8.
I mean, it could be. Because
I could be, I know, I'm going to stop pushing people. When I'm done, it'll be a 14. I know. Okay, anybody else? Give me a number.
Me?
Yeah, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think
Seven.
Yeah. Okay, another number. Give me a number.
A two or a three.
A two or a three. Thank you. A two or a three. Which one? Two and a half and a seven plus. I have a sense that there's a seven plus lurking in your head somewhere. Anybody else? Yes.
Eight.
Two and a half, eight. Anybody else? Give me a number, yeah?
Nine.
Nine. Which high school did you go to? Where is that? Really? Mashahu. Columbus Torah Academy.
Yeah.
Mashahu. Okay, wonderful. Anybody else? I'm not gonna ask Rabbi Terezin. It's not fair. Okay. Anybody else? You have any thoughts? Ladies? Eight. Okay. Two and a half. Why two and a half? Which high school did you go to?
SKA.
SKA. Two and a half from SKA. Wow. Love it.
I think about it.
You should love your year here. You should have such a wonderful year. You should be Sameach. Not being really on the spot. I want you to be happy. Male Simcha. So we have a two and a half and we have a nine. And let me just say something. Whatever number you choose, Tavor Lechem Bracha, it's your number. You have a right to choose. I respect your assessment. This is not a correct answer and a wrong answer. This is a very subjective assessment. Whatever you say is your feeling. You're entitled to your feelings, and that's perfectly 100%. The first point that I want to make is that somebody who said a 9 or an 8 or a 7 plus essentially is pretty much agreeing with Rabbi Cutler and understands, yeah, it makes sense that Rabbi Cutler would go ballistic after reading this. Somebody who says a 2.5 says, wow, Rabbi Cutler really must think that even this, which for me is, you know, it's like a quarter bad, 2.5 out of 10. He considers it to be a 14. I mean, Rabbi Cutler is off the charts about this. So you have a different assessment of the harifut of Rabbi Cutler's position based on how you see this. That's point number one, right? You understand what I'm saying? To internalize how strongly Rabbi Cutler felt that such kind of language is utterly irresponsible, and he calls it despicable blasphemy. Point number two is that what I just said is totally irrelevant. That's point number two. Having said that, it really doesn't matter. Why doesn't it matter? Because what year are we living in? What year are we living in? 2017. When was this written? 1935. Therefore, in order to assess more accurately Rabbi Cutler's position, we cannot base it on what we think on December 27th, 2017. We need to try to imagine what would a Jew living in Warsaw on April 16th, so this was March 29th, 19, how would they have reacted to it? And what we today consider a 2, a 3, a 4, a 5, or a 6, if today it's a 7 or an 8 or a 9, then I would say Kal Vachomer, in a more traditional society, it would have been a 13 or a 14 or a 16. So at the end of the day, to assess Rabbi Cutler in the context in which he is writing, we have to situate ourselves in that context and then make an assessment. Okay, point number three. Maybe, Rabbi Cutler was as harif as he was because he was really upset at Itzik Manger. He found himself now polemicizing. What does it mean to polemicize, to be involved in a polemic, in an argument? Manger is floating out there. Manger is out in the world. Manger is in Jewish people's houses. And he has to go on the warpath against Manger. Maybe point number three, maybe, comma, question mark. He went a little bit more harif than he might otherwise have gone in a calmer situation. Somebody would have said to him, Rebbe, what do I think about, what do you think about the avot? Maybe he would have been a little calmer, like a number less. And the reason why he is so, quote, despicable blasphemy is because he's on the warpath. I want to show you. Okay, we're good. We got it so far. Here's where I'm thinking. I want to share that Rabbi Cutler believed what he said, even without the context of polemicizing against Itzhak Mager. Bottom right page. When did Rabbi Cutler come to the United States? I mentioned it to you. I don't expect you to remember, so I'm going to remind you again. 1941. When did he found the yeshiva in Lakewood? 1942. He died in 1963 or 1964. In the early 60s, he already had Talmidim who had gone through his yeshiva. His yeshiva started in 1942, so we're looking at 18 years worth of chevra, who already started to become rebbes in different schools. So they learned in the yeshiva for 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 8 years. Then they got a job teaching in some school. In the early 60s, they had a convention. And they invited their Rebbe, Rabaro, to tell them how should they teach the Avot and the Imahot to their students. So they're sitting under a tree somewhere on a sunny day in the Catskill Mountains, north of New York City. And he's telling them how he believes they, the idyllic surroundings of this beautiful space, should teach the Avot and the Imahot. He did not write it down. It was an oral shiur. One of those who was present wrote it down and published it, and later was included in the collected works of Rabbi Aaron Cutler, published by his children, grandchildren, and most trusted students, which means that his children, grandchildren, and most trusted students considered this to be an authoritative representation of their father, grandfather, Rebbe's position. And so we have the following on the bottom right. This was printed, it's called Mishnas Rav Aaron Chelev Gimel, Lakewood, 1988. That's when it was published. It is a 12-page essay. It must have taken him 4 or 5 hours to unload this whole thought process. I'm giving you a few lines. Bottom right, page 3. We're still with Rabbi Cutler. Kishini gashim le'inyan Yishmael v'Yitzchak v'hasagot v'hashkafot shel anashim regilim. We're now looking at the debate between Yishmael and Yitzchak. And if we were to enter into this discussion from the perspective of, like, regular people, u'befrat b'dor hazeh, especially in this generation, which is the early 60s. If Shalit told it's possible to make a mistake, Shaita kan tigra ben shtei nashim al zchuyot b'nehen. And what's really an issue was two mommies are fighting about their sons. Each mother is pushing for her son. So who's the mother of Yitzchak? And who's the mother of Yishmael? Hagar. So it's a fight between Sarah and Hagar, each one is sticking up, put up your dukes. My son should be the one who should be the future of our family. Says Rabbi Cutler, Asur laha'alot zot al da'at, prohibited to think like this. And then he continues to say, U'machshava zu hi kfira mamish. What does kfira mean?
Heresy.
What does mamish mean? Mamish heresy. You can't really translate mamish into English. Super duper heresy. Now, had Rav Moshe just said, it's kfira, that would have been enough for me. I mean, not Rav Moshe, Rav Aaron. Had Rav Aaron said, it's kfira, so that's okay. But it's not just kfira, it's kfira mamish. It is absolute mamish heresy.
And he also continues to say as follows. Let's now skip to Lahavin, line number 6, towards the end of the line. Lahavin in Yanzeh, line 6, towards the end of the line. Lahavin in Yanzeh lefi kamut ve'echut hasagateinu. In order to understand this based on the length and breadth of our understanding, tzarich lada'at she'ein avot ela shlosha, we only have 3 avot. Now comes the line that is absolutely crucial for this discussion. V'ilu haya pegam kol shehu ba'avot. What is pegam? A pegam. Pegima. Pegam. Pe gimel mem. Anybody? Blemish or defect. If there were ilu haya pegam, what's kol shehu? Anybody? The slightest. If the avot had even the slightest blemish or defect. Next line. V'yehi ze pegam dak min hadak. What does dak mean? Thin. In this context, the thinnest of the thin, or more precisely in English translation, the slightest of the slight, even the teeny weeniest smidgen of a pagam, of a blemish or a defect, haitako mitziyut am Yisrael acheret, everything would be different. So Rabbi Cutler, sitting under a tree somewhere on a sunny day in the spring, in the early 60s in upstate New York, there's no Manger, there's no Haint. He's now a Rebbe teaching Talmidim how to present to their third graders, fourth graders, seventh graders the Torah stories. Tells them there is no pagam. Translate pagam again? Blemish or defect. There's no pagam kol shehu. What's kol shehu? The slightest. Even. Pagam kol shehu. Dak min hadak. Even. The slightest of the slightest. Rabbi Kotler's position is zero pagam, and they are absolute perfect. Now, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because there are a number of Gemaras and the Drushim that do seem to, but for the sake of our conversation this evening, I'm reading to you Rabbi Aaron's statement. There is no pagam, there's no pagam kol shehu, there's no pagam kol shehu, dak min hadak. The most luminous, the loftiest, the holiest, the greatest, the most perfect personalities. So according to Rabbi Aaron, it is inappropriate to think anything other than the most highest, sublime, respectful thoughts about the Avot and the Imahot. To counter Rabbi Cutler, I want to introduce you to Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. Anybody ever hear of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch? I see a hand, yes? You know anything? What could you tell us?
A little after?
Lived in Germany. Yes, he lived in Germany, he died in Germany, he's buried in Germany. Where, when did he live? What century? What century did he live? What? I still can't. Give me a century, a number. A century. Now we're in the 21st century. We're in the 21st century. We've been here for a while. So what century did he live in? 19th century. He lived in Germany. He fought against the Reform. He was a rabbi in Frankfurt. He's buried in Frankfurt. He was a rabbi in Frankfurt. He was a community leader. And his goal was, he had a certain sisma, he had a certain ideology, to bring together clear commitment to Torah, to Mesorah, to Judaism, as well as an understanding of the world around him. What was it called? Torah in Derech Eretz. And he wrote a lot, including a commentary on the Torah, in German, translated on page 4 into English. So now what I want to do is to present Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. And when we are done, I am going to ask you, are you a Rabbi Hirschian or are you a Rabbi Cutlerian? That's going to be my question for you to think about. Let's look on page 4. We are now going to look on page 4, halfway down the first paragraph, the line beginning, that need. Page 4, this is Rav Shamsu Rafael Hirsch's Perish on Sefer Bereshis, Perek Yudeis. The Torah, a little bit more than halfway down this line. The Torah never presents, are you with me? Anybody? The Torah, it's like halfway down the first paragraph towards the end of the line, first paragraph, page 4. Line beginning, that need. The Torah never presents our great men as being perfect. It deifies no man. Says of none, here, with this person, you have the ideal. In this man, the divine became human. The Torah never says, you know how you should behave? You should behave like that person. The Torah, says Rabbi Hirsch, never says that. Altogether, it puts the life of no man before us as the pattern out of which we ought to learn what is right and good, what we have to do, or what we refrain from doing. Where the Torah wants to give us an example, you see that? That's how you should behave. The Torah does not point to a person, but it's kind of ironically and maybe shockingly, the Torah points to who? To the Rabbono Shel Olam himself. Where the word of God would set a pattern before us to imitate, it places no man born of dust. There God says, look at me. What's the pasuk? The halachta b'derachav. We should follow in God's ways. Say so the Gemara darshans. Mahu afata, mahu chanun afata chanun, mahu rachum afata rachum, mahu gomel chasadim afata gomel chasadim, mahu kover meitim afata kover meitim, mahu mevaker cholim afata mevaker cholim. God points to himself. You should act the way I act in terms of chesed to another human being. The Torah never, says Rabbi Hirsch, says, you see that person? That's what you should do. Never. We are never to say, this must be right, for did not so and so do it. The Torah is no collection of examples of saints. It relates what occurred not because it was exemplary, but because it occurred. Next sentence, red pen, underline. The Torah, Rabbi Samson Reifer, a fine Jew, nice Jew, respected Jew, pious Jew, incredible, incredible rabbi, saved generations of German Jews. We still are benefiting from his wisdom and insights. Wrote, the Torah never hides from us the faults, errors, and weaknesses of our great men. So what does that tell us about our great men? Help me out, that they had faults, errors, and weaknesses. And how do I know? Because the Torah doesn't hide them. So you will say, continues Rabbi Hirsch, so we have less derech eretz for them because they have faults, errors, and weaknesses. So somehow, is that going to lead you to somehow, chas v'shalom, undermine your respect for them? He continues and he says exactly the opposite. That actually gives us more respect for them than were we to believe that they had no faults, errors, and weaknesses. Just by that, it gives the stamp of veracity to what it relates. In truth, by the knowledge which is given us of their faults and weaknesses, our great men are in no wise made lesser, but actually greater and more instructive. If they stood before us as the purest models of perfection, we should attribute them as having a different nature which has been denied to us. Were they without passion, without internal struggles, without, quote, back to the beginning of the paragraph, faults, errors, and weaknesses, their virtues would seem to us the outcome of some higher nature, hardly a merit, and certainly no model that we could hope to emulate. 2 points he makes. Point number 1 is, if somebody is born perfect, and they act perfect. So what do you expect? They don't get credit. They don't get credit for acting perfect. You know why they're acting perfect? Why? Why are they acting perfect? Because they're born perfect. Their DNA is perfection. So of course they're going to be perfect. When do you get credit for becoming an Avraham and a Yitzchak and a Yaakov and a Sarah and a Rivka and Rachel and Leah? If you're born with challenges and issues and you work on yourself and then you become, oh my God, one of the Avot or Imahot, now you're talking. That is amazing. That is amazing. Look what they became. It wasn't so simple for them. It wasn't so obvious for them. It wasn't so straightforward for them. They had to work on themselves. You have much more respect for somebody who overcomes challenges than somebody who just kind of waltzes right in and has everything set for them and done for them and made for them and ready for them. Adarabba, says Rabbi Hirsch, you have greater than rachmanis, number one. Number two, he says, the second is what I call the didactic argument. If they're perfect, what can I learn from them? Guess what? I'm not perfect. They're perfect. They're living on Mars. They're living somewhere in the clouds. I can't connect to that. I can't relate to that. Their story is not my story. They're perfect. It's a whole different galaxy. It's a whole different language. But if they too had to overcome and work on themselves, yes, I know, and I said it earlier, in 29 trillion years, I will never come to the teeny weeniest of their greatness. But I can identify with that. I can identify with what it means to try to do better, to try to face up to whatever issues I have. All of us, we all have issues. We all know, each one of us individually, the kinds of stuff we have to work with and the kinds of challenges that we have, and to try to concentrate and to try to grow spiritually and to try to appreciate Torah and appreciate God and appreciate the values of our tradition. You know, there's stuff. You know, we're modern young people and there's a world around us and there's all kinds of stuff going on, and we have issues. So if we look at Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and we see that they struggled, I'll never be that. I'll never be anywhere near that. But now, that's kind of my language. That's my world. And so Rabbi Hirsch says, there are faults, errors, and weaknesses. The Torah tells us about that. And guess what? We have even greater than in the model of Rabbi Kotler. Rabbi Kotler's model, you expect them to be the greatest of the great, because that's what they are. They're perfect. So they should get credit. They should get tzchar. You should like give them a brownie or a lollipop because they're like, behave good. Of course they're going to behave good. And, second of all, what does that have to do with me? It's nothing to do with me. Their whole DNA, their very essence, is entirely different than mine. But if they are imbued at the beginning with issues that they have to overcome, says Rabbi Hirsch, look what they became. Look what they became. Amazing. Now I have respect for them. I have huge respect for them, because it wasn't a slam dunk. It wasn't obvious. It wasn't automatic. It was something they worked on. And you know what? That inspires me. That inspires me. I won't be like that. In 190 billion trillion years, I won't be like that. But I could try to emulate the method of the struggle and the overcoming of the struggle. So we have two perspectives. You remember the larger issue that I began with was the issue of authority and the place of authority and the role of authority. I remember when I was, 5 years old, 6 years old, I thought my parents were perfect. I don't remember at what age
I began to realize that my parents were not perfect. I couldn't really say that out loud because, like, they had to feed me and clothe me and pay for my tuition, and I didn't want to mess up my relationship with them. But at some point, and I am sure I'm speaking for each one of you, at some point, you're now at the stage where you realize your parents are amazing, incredible, gifted, kind. They're paying your tuition to come here. They're allowing you to come here. You have to call them. You have to call them 3 times a day. I mean, that's the deal, right? You don't call your parents. Each of you have one of these. I saw there's a box outside with a couple. I don't know where the rest of them went. There were much fewer phones in the box than there are people sitting in this room. So I'm assuming you didn't even bring it down. You must have left it in your room, and you go up like once a day to your room to look at the, but the rest of the time, only a Yechidei Segula brought it down. You realize, oh my God, how could I brought down my phone? I have to leave it over there. You call your parents 2-3 times a day. You check in. If you don't call your parents, they get nervous. They turn on the radio. God forbid, maybe something happened in Yerushalayim. I spent a year in Israel learning in Yeshivat Mir. It's not very far from here. It's a little far from here. Yeshivat Mir in Beit Yisrael, right off of Rehov Meir Sha'arim, in 1968 and 1969. So that was before you were born. That was safe to say. I spoke to my parents once the entire year. The entire year. I didn't have this. You know that in my lifetime, we didn't have this. You're going to tell your grandchildren you met a guy when you were in your year in Israel who told you that when he was young, he didn't have an iPhone. This is very new. I made an appointment at the main post office on Rehov Yaakov with an international operator 2 months in advance. I made an appointment. And the international operator said, okay, there's a Rishima. Come in 2 months from now at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I came on that day at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. You know there's a main post office on Rehov Yafo, like towards the end of Yafo. It's close to the Shlom Tzion Hamalka, right? You've been around long enough, you know where that is? See, post office. So it wasn't just the post office. They had cubicles with phones. I got there at 1 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, I hear my name called. And from the other side of the wall, somebody yells out, Schechter, go to the cubicle. I stand at the cubicle. I stand, there's no seat. And I hear, okay, you can now pick up the phone. I pick up the phone. And I couldn't hear anything. It was like static, crazy. The whole call lasted 90 seconds. I couldn't, hi, how you doing? Hi, Mom, love you. Okay, it's great, I love it, it's great. I need money, everything is fine, send money. Everything is great, great, I need more money, and I need sperm, and I need money. Just send money, I need money. Bang, can't hear anything, hung up 90 seconds for the whole year. That was it for the whole year. So you have to call your parents, and your parents love you, and you know that. But at some point you realize, you know, there's stuff. So how do we understand the nature of our relationship to our parents, to our teachers, to our rabbis? How do we understand the nature of our relationship with the Mesorah, with the tradition? It's clear that we have to submit to the tradition. And how to work that through is the stuff of young adulthood, and I would even say the stuff of life. I want to conclude with one final thought on Rabbi Hirsch's position. Rabbi Hirsch said, I gave you 2, I would say, pretty stark opposing perspectives. And I would ask you at some point to vote. I don't know if I should ask you now to vote who's a Rabbi Hirschian and who's a Rabbi Kotlerian. But I want to add one nipuda here, and that is, even Rabbi Hirsch, what did Rabbi Hirsch say? Give me the quote. That our forefathers have what quote?
False
errors and weaknesses. How do you think Rabbi Hirsch would have reacted to Itzik Manger's poem?
And I would say Rabbi Hirsch would have been very upset with Itzik Manger's poem. In other words, there are faults, errors, and weaknesses, and there are faults, errors, and weaknesses. Some of them, Rabbi Hirsch says, they had. Some of them, I am suggesting to you and invite you to think about, even Rabbi Hirsch would say, you can't talk that way about them. You can't say certain things about them. And for me, that's where the work needs to be done. So if I were here longer, and if I was in a position to actually give you an assignment, which I am neither, so you could relax, I invite you, at some point over the course of the next whatever, take out a pen and a piece of paper or a computer, whatever you use, and try to put on paper or on the computer screen, how do you understand Rabbi Hirsch's position? Okay, Rabbi Hirsch is not Rabbi Kotler. Rabbi Hirsch says, okay, we can think about it, and as a matter of fact, we have even greater derech eretz for them. But not everything goes. So what goes and what doesn't go? What is appropriate and what is not appropriate? And how do we think about determining what is appropriate and what is not appropriate? And then, through this narrow lens of attitude towards the avot and the imahot, we can begin to extrapolate a larger perspective on the nature of authority in general. I wish all of you a wonderful, wonderful rest of the year. Take advantage of it. If you're coming to Stern College, I look forward to seeing you in my class. If you're going somewhere else, have a great time. If you're staying in Israel, tavoy lechem bracha. Take advantage of the next couple of months. And I wish all of you great continued nachat and simcha and success and great achievements in the last few months that you have here in this absolutely incredible school. Laila Tov.
Thank you.